At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
I caught a quick ride this past Friday from our China correspondent, Jennifer Pack.
This is definitely not like my minivan.
All right. Welcome to Beijing.
Thank you. It is, it's crazy to be back, to be totally honest with you. I was talking to one of my kids, my oldest son, the other day, and asking him when was the last time we were here. And I was like, it's got to be like 2018 or something. He said, no, it's 2015.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
对,
San Litun, my old neighborhood from when I lived in Beijing back in the 90s.
不要东直门是吧?
这里是东直门吗,师傅?
对.
Yes.
Okay.
I kind of recognized where we were going, kind of not, though, given how fast and how much China has changed in the past couple of decades.
Yeah. Yes, let's climb up here and walk around.
So coming up on the program today, China, what we saw while we were there. Oh, and a chat in Beijing with the Secretary of the Treasury. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday. This is the 10th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. One does not, of course, just show up at Andrews Air Force Base and get on the shiny white and blue plane that's going to take Janet Yellen to China. So after making the appropriate requests and applications and completing the requisite red tape and catching a shuttle bus at the Treasury Building at 5 o'clock in the morning, 20-something hours later, we landed in Beijing.
So we're in San Litun right now.
We are. I'm going to walk on the road because you're walking on the road. So if you get us killed, it's on you. That's all I'm saying.
But it's filled with bikes right now on the sidewalk.
I wanted to come, first of all, because it's my job, but also because I lived and worked in China back in the day, and I'll take any chance I can get to get back to see what's been happening. Yellen's visit, her first in office, comes at a challenging time. There has been a changing of the economic guard in Beijing. The relationship between the two biggest economies in the world is, if not fraught, definitely tense, and trust is low. There were, over the 2.5 days we were on the ground, a couple of high-level meetings, various photo ops, a 45-minute press conference, and not too long before we got back on the plane to come back, an interview with me in the press attaché's office at the American Embassy.
Secretary Yellen, welcome to the program. It's good to have you back on.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Kai.
Last time we spoke, back in March, you were pretty clear that what you're trying to do with the Chinese is establish a floor to this relationship to stop it from getting more destabilized. And I guess my question is, do you think this trip has done that?
I think it's certainly been constructive and helped because really over the last several years, and especially with COVID, there's been very little communication between people, not only officials, but also just citizens of America and China. We've grown apart and misunderstandings have developed. And to stabilize our relationship, to put a floor under it and hopefully begin to improve it over time, it's necessary to meet, to discuss our differences openly with respect, and to develop channels of regular communication. And that certainly was a major goal of my trip. I think it was successful in that sense.
So let me take you back then to a speech you gave in April as a precursor to this trip. And in point of fact, you mentioned in that speech you wanted to come to Beijing in the near future. And you said one of the things you're trying to get across to the Chinese is that, and this is a quote from your speech, China's economic growth need not be incompatible with U.S. economic leadership, right? So let me poke you in the eye a little bit. What if the Chinese give a speech and say, America's economic growth need not be incompatible with Chinese leadership? How do you react to that?
Well, we need to find ways to both work together to have a significant role in the global economy. And certainly China has expressed the view that it's important for both of us to be able to thrive in a global economy.
So let me go about it a different way then. One of the things you've said repeatedly, you said it on this trip, you've said it in all the speeches you've given and in the public presentations, is that you want to make it clear that the Chinese understand that America taking steps in its national security do not mean that we are going to compete with them unfairly economically, right? You want to make sure that national security is a prime factor in the American policy.
Yes.
How do they react to that when you bring that up? I mean, you spent 10 hours, as you just said in this press conference, you spent 10 hours over 2 days. And I guess my question is, when you say it's national security, it's not economic competition, what do they say to you?
Well, they're concerned, of course, that it may be economic competition and that our motive may go beyond national security. So my job is to try to explain to them that we have been and intend to be transparent about the actions that we've taken and are contemplating, that the motive and objective is national security, although beyond that, we've made clear that supply chain resilience is also important, especially in the aftermath of the pandemic, and that some of the actions that we have taken reflect our desire to diversify our supply chains. And so I spent many hours with my counterpart going through in detail our concerns and addressing them. If they're concerned that the impact of our actions goes well beyond national security and has a negative impact on their well-being broadly, that we're open to listening to that concern.
Did they reciprocate and say, Janet, you can call me anytime?
We have certainly agreed that we will maintain open channels of communication and deepen our discussion of concerns that one another have.
That's not a yes.
Well, it's pretty much a yes,
right,
in the sense that we fully expect to have more frequent communications to explore concerns.
I want to get to the de-risking and decoupling thing that you have talked about, and there is sentiment out there amongst the Chinese that what you are trying to do, what you and the Biden administration are trying to do, is to decouple from the Chinese economy, the two biggest economies in the world, separating in a way, and you're trying to make the point that de-risking the American economy, providing our national security and changing our supply chains, is not decoupling. How do you make the average American understand that?
Well, the United States and China have almost $700 billion of trade this year. Mm-hmm. And most of this trade, and we have American firms that are active in China and have been active in China. They have been here for decades. I was able to meet with businesses here that are active in hospitals, in medical devices, in agriculture, that really don't implicate national security concerns. And we both benefit from these economic interactions. And I've said I think it would be disastrous to attempt to disentangle all of that economic activity and something that would be disruptive to both our economies and the global economy.
You, as you say in your speeches, you're an economist by trade. You look at the world through that lens. And you have been interacting with China for a number of years now, both in your prior capacities and now in this job. And you're a labor economist specifically. And I wonder what you see when you look at the Chinese economy from when you first started coming here and today, right? Because it's a labor challenge that this economy is dealing with.
Well, they have 1.4 billion people. And I guess what I see is an economy that over many decades has opened up, has developed, and has lifted many millions of people out of poverty, which is a very substantial achievement. And trade and investment with the United States and with other countries have been part of what's enabled that progress. One thing, of course, I noticed being in Beijing, certainly since I was here last, is that the air is cleaner. Yes. They've addressed a serious pollution problem. And while they are, I believe, the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter, they have made substantial investments that have resulted in technological innovation in electric cars, renewables, that have the potential to benefit not only our own efforts, but to be transferable around the world in ways that will make the project of mitigating climate change more cost-effective.
Do you think you can do it? Do you think the Biden administration, through your work and Secretary Blinken's and Secretary Kerry's, I mean, Ambassador Kerry now is coming, can you stabilize it? Because there are so many challenges.
There are challenges, but I believe there is a desire on both sides to stabilize the relationship and to constructively address problems that each of us see, to do so frankly, with candor, and to build a productive relationship going forward.
This gets to my next question, but when a diplomat says frankly and candidly, that's always code word for, man, those are tough conversations.
Well, I spent more than 5 hours yesterday with my counterpart discussing a very wide range of issues, macroeconomic developments in our own economies that influence the global outlook, things concerning debt and climate change, health issues. And we frankly set out our concerns and invited further in-depth discussions by our staff over time to sort out our concerns.
I have to tell you, I was in the pool spray, that photo spray at the top of that meeting where Minister Ho read his statement and you read yours. And we got to the end of yours, and in the last paragraph, you mentioned that we will not compromise on national security concerns, even though it harms us economically. And I was watching Minister Ho when you said that, and you could see his face get a little tense. It was interesting to see.
Well, it's an area of concern because this is a motivation for us to place some restrictions on technology that can be sold or transferred to China from the United States. Now, I would point out that China has some similar restrictions.
Which I'm sure they are.
It's a concern on both sides.
I get that. But I'm sure they're saying, look, the U.S. is doing it. Why can't we do it? Right?
Well, we both do it because national security is a critical concern. And I certainly made clear that we're not going to back off protecting national security, that that's something that they need to understand. But that when we do that, we will try to make sure that our actions are clear, transparent, narrowly targeted, and provide channels by which they can tell us if they feel that it goes beyond that and is harming them.
Okay, last thing, because I know you and we have a plane to catch. I was thinking about you in this job. You've been an economist for decades now. right? But as I was watching you the other day come down the steps off that plane with the red carpet and Ambassador Burns and the Chinese government greeting you and all the cameras, it occurred to me, and clearly you've thought of this before, you're no longer an economist, really. You're a diplomat. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, it's an honor to be able to contribute to the improvement of the functioning of the international economy. And this is one of the most important bilateral relationships and economic and financial relationships that we have. And its functioning well should matter and does matter to the American people, the Chinese people, and the globe. And being able to contribute to making that relationship work well is a responsibility and an honor to be entrusted with that.
Madam Secretary, I appreciate your time, as always.
Thank you.
More from Beijing, straight ahead.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The thing about China, and sure, all places change over time. That is normal. But the thing about China is how much it has changed and how fast it has done so. Sanlitun, my old neighborhood, where Jennifer and I wound up last Friday, used to be old apartment buildings and vegetable stands and hole-in-the-wall bars catering to expat Westerners. Now, there's an Apple store, Chanel and Dior shops, and high-end restaurants. And should you be in need as you fight your jet lag, a coffee stand. Apologies, by the way, for the guys cutting slabs of new sidewalk that you're going to hear in the background.
So let's take a look at the price of coffee here. Okay, so usually I get a cappuccino. Okay, they don't have one, but a latte. You see, a hot one is 35
for a small.
That's like $5. Do you know prices all went up when Starbucks raised their prices? Whole country,
you
because
know.
Starbucks set the
what?
Coffee culture.
Right. Why wait?
And they thought, yeah, we can charge $5.
I'm going to get a cup of coffee.
Here you go. Let's go get a cup of coffee.
Okay. 你好.
Latte,
huh? Latte.
Hmm?
两杯。对。
热的。
哦，大的那个热的，对。当然热的。Can't have a cold latte. No cold lattes. 不要冷的 latte， 那不行。
嗯？一杯吗？
Actual money as opposed to paying on WeChat.
Well, you're very lucky.
I know. I had this whole conversation with the concierge last night about finding a restaurant that would take credit cards, and he called this place, and she was like, 不是国外的，就是国内的.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what?
And
that guo wai and guo nei there is the restaurant lady telling the concierge, yeah, she would take domestic credit cards, not credit cards from foreign banks, though.
The credit card penetration is very low.
But if I put my credit card in WeChat and paid with WeChat, mm-hmm. that would that be all right?
Yeah, of course, because the guarantor is WeChat.
Yeah.
What they worry about is the fees, first of all.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because, right. Yeah, the banks charge very high fees for credit cards.
Sorry, I'm just looking at what bank my credit card is from. Chase, right?
Well, let's see how far you get with your cash.
So Chase Bushing. Yeah, I don't know. It's wild, actually.
是不是很少人有现金啊，现在?
So that was Jen asking the barista how many people use cash, and him saying, yeah, they kind of do.
So yes, they also have people paying in cash. I'm not the only stupid foreigner. That's what that was. That's what that exchange was.
So, with coffee in hand, paid for in cash, a walk and talk with Jennifer Pack about China then and now. Straight ahead. We went to Beijing last week because, yes, sure, Janet Yellen was gone, and to some degree you gotta cover the macro, the big picture economic relationship, even as you try to explain the micro, what is happening on the ground. But mostly we went because the relationship between our two economies is gonna be the story of our economic future. Jennifer Pack has been in Shanghai for Marketplace for 6 years, maybe a little bit longer. Before that, though, she was in Beijing, living not far from Sanlitun, my old neighborhood, watching, as the rest of us were, as China changed. There is now a generation of people between the time you and I were here and who are now like 18 years old, right? And they've now grown up expecting this. They're used to the high end. They're used to disposable income. And that's just not the way it used to be.
No. Yeah. Well, so that's the thing. That's the funny thing is, even back when I was here, I would interview people who are the first generation who went to university.
Yeah.
That's still a lot of them.
Yeah.
And they would say, you know, when I was growing up, it was very poor. But now the older I get, the more money I have, the more I want. And
Right. They
feel actually kind of a lot of pressure. And there's this sort of yearning. So every time there's some sort of cyclical downturn in the economy, you hear a lot of, especially people who have been living in the mega cities for a while, they want to acquire a piece of land in the countryside or turn it into a Airbnb. And it's a thing. It's a sort of a romanticization of, you know.
Well, look, it's aspirational capitalism, right?
Is that what it's called?
It kind of is.
Okay, we got to figure out.
Keeping up with the Joneses?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's
huge. You know, that's kind of what it is.
That's huge. Keeping up with the Joneses.
Say more about that.
So especially in the countryside, we hear a lot of people, they call it panbi, so they just kind of, try to one-up each other. People here talk like they speak for 1.4 billion people, so they'll say, oh, everybody does this.
And
so there's this sort of pressure, especially for young people. When we interview them ahead of the Lunar New Year, which is the time to go home, a lot of them say, you know what, I kind of don't really want to go home. I'm expected to pay for everything just because I work in the city. When I go back, he has to take all his classmates out for dinner. Everyone turns to him when the bill arrives, like, well, I'm just going to recycle this.
Yeah. So it must be incredible to you that, 8 months ago now, you were in the middle of still lockdowns and zero COVID, and now it's normal? Kind of?
Yeah, I think we're on the way to normal, as in people just are so sick of it. They don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
No tabulation about the death toll, but, you know, you still hear and see ambulances here and now and again.
Yeah.
But everybody really just wants to get to work. And that's what we heard during the pandemic. They're like, look, I'm not looking for a handout. I don't care what policies. I just want to get back to work.
Right?
That is a big thing. And the economy slowed down. And it's noticeable for a lot of people because...
Is it you think people can feel the slowdown?
Absolutely. In terms of, they're getting back to normal. But it's not like they're going to spend as they used to.
Right.
People are paying down their debts because they're really worried. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty, and part of that really stems from this idea that if a megacity like Shanghai, and even Beijing was somewhat pretty much like a fortress, it was very difficult to get in here. You almost had to apply for a new passport to get in here. If that can happen to a megacity in a moment's notice, you know, then anything's possible.
What's the general perception of the United States, of the American economy, of how things are working? Or do people not think about it? And they're just trying to pay the rent.
I say most people are trying to pay the rent, but they obviously have a lot of intuition about what's happening. They know that the U.S. and China are going through a phase, shall we say?
Shall we say? We shall, yes.
And I would say that the narrative, especially pushed out by the Chinese government media, is that America's on the decline and China's on the rise. Now, this is very much before 2022, okay? Remember, when you guys were all locked down and the rest of the world, factories were pumping things out.
Yeah.
I was living semi-normal life, as in if I didn't leave the city boundary, I was fine. So there was that illusion, but since 2022 and the lockdowns, I would say that people are a lot less optimistic, but I'm not sure necessarily relative to the U.S. I think they still think the trajectory is we're going to go up at some point. And that's sort of how they view all of the actions from whether it's the Trump administration or the Biden administration, is that, you know, it's because they are on, America's on the decline, and therefore that's why all of these actions are to suppress us, to contain and suppress us. That's the term that the Chinese officials use.
Some final thoughts about that, huh, from me, you heard right there. They are coming up. I've been in and out of China personally and professionally for almost 30 years now, with Marketplace for the first time in 2005 and 2006. And our approach on that trip, and our approach on this trip too, was all about how much things have changed in China and how fast. So this past Saturday morning, I went out for a walk just to see and hear what I could see and hear.
Oh man, I should get some sound of those electric scooters. I don't know if you can hear this. Or are you going to hear the wheels? Hang on a minute. Do you hear that? That's an electric scooter. So all the scooters here used to be, you know, like the Vespas and stuff, those little motor scooters. They used to be all those really dirty two-stroke engines. And now they're all electrified. They're batteries. And everybody's got them. And they're just so quiet. It's kind of amazing. I mean, it's great, obviously, right? But it's just kind of wild.
Might not sound like much. I mean, literally, because they are so quiet. But you have to remember, it wasn't all that many years ago that bicycles were the way most people in that economy got around. There are all kinds of stories like that that anybody who has lived and worked in China could tell you. And it's one of the reasons that people keep coming back, because every single day you see something or you hear something and you say to yourself, huh, I wonder what happens next. Okay. That's all we've got for today. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow back in L.A. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.